Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is probably finale, I would say, of the Berlinale series. So I thought it would be perfect to end where we began, which is with Jordan Kronk. And we had started off, now it feels like many moons ago, actually probably only like a week and a half ago, I guess. But that's festival time. It's like dog years, I guess, or the opposite of dog years. But anyway, hello, Jordan. Now you're back home. Full disclosure, we are both back each in our respective homes.
Yes. Hi, Nick. I am back home. Got back yesterday, which was the day of the awards, I guess. So when I landed, I saw the winners, and I've been recovering, still recovering, but ever since then.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on the winners? I mean, I was pretty happy with like this.
I mean, I thought the winners were good. Pretty much every movie I liked in competition won something. So for me, it
Oh,
was
wow.
pretty nice. I think everyone kind of thought the Matty Diop film would win, and it's a worthy winner for sure. One of the best in competition. But then, like from there, it really ranged, which was cool to see Hong. I think Hong's won something like every year that Carlo's been running the festival, which is actually appropriate. But I mean, I guess the most surprising is Dumont, which I love that he won something, but I was not expecting that, I guess.
I guess that was a surprise to me as well. And you heard firsthand how baffled, I mean, pleasantly baffled I was by that
No, I was happy to see Pepe. I assume Pepe would had a chance at maybe winning the whole thing or definitely getting a top prize for sure, and he won Best Director, so that was cool to see. So none of the bad films won anything, which is not always the case, so
film. Yeah, I don't even want to name any, but yeah, I definitely had fears about a couple things. But
yeah.
yeah, it seemed to work out. Well, I thought we could start out with a film that after I had sort of realized I hadn't really talked about, I saw was on your list. You promulgated on the Twitter as one of your picks for the festival, and actually I think also won a prize because it was in this sort of weirdly in the generation section,
Oh, right.
and I think it won the top prize or won the audience prize. I wasn't even sure on that one.
Yeah, it's called Who by Fire. It won the generation section, which is weird. I guess a section for youth-oriented films, but that doesn't really do this film justice. It kind of pigeonholes it in a way.
Yeah. So yeah, what did you think of Who by Fire? Which, by the way, I think it's like the second film with a Leonard Cohen reference in the title.
So someone pointed that out or made that connection to me as well. I was like, oh yeah. Yeah, it has kind of a strange, like, I mean, it works for the film, but it's kind of a poetic title more than anything.
Yeah.
In any case, this is the new film by Philippe Lesage. He's a French-Canadian Quebecois filmmaker, and he makes these super ambitious narrative films. And this is another one in a run of these kind of films. This is a 2 hour and 40-minute, I guess you'd call it a cabin in the woods type film, gestures at genre, but isn't really a horror film, isn't really like a thriller, but has a lot of these things going on. Isn't really a musical, but has like three or four musical sequences.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, it's sort of a hard movie to like describe in just a few sentences, but it by and large deals with two former collaborators, a director and a screenwriter, who travel with a group of people, which includes family members and then other acquaintances, to this cabin in like the woods of Quebec, where I don't know. They're like trying to make up a little bit. They've had a strained relationship because the director has gone on to make documentaries and thus doesn't need a screenwriter anymore. While the screenwriter has now taking more commercial type jobs, so there's some like strain in their relationship. And the screenwriter comes with his son and daughter, and also a friend of the son, a male friend. So those are the main characters, and then there's like a peripheral group that go with them as well, who all have different roles in the proceedings. But it basically just charts their weekend or week at this cabin, where old wounds are opened, and like the passive aggressive tension between the two former collaborators kind of reaches a boil at one point, and then the kind of drama between the kids revolves around the friend having an interest in the sister character. And that boy's like kind of a, I don't know, sexual awakening or sexual, like, yeah, just his fraught way of dealing with kind of being attracted to this young girl, which
Yeah.
moves in some pretty surprising directions and also very funny. Yeah, I don't know. It's a film that like tries so many different things. It's a movie of like really long sequence shots built around conversations in most cases. I mean, the main like motif is this like dinner setup where they convene every night and they have these like long conversations, which at one point started to remind me of like Sierra Nevada. It's super like drawn out, like darkly humorous, like conversations that are passive aggressive, and you know, in one instance eventually boils over with the two former collaborators fighting. But yeah, it's just a really ambitious film that like goes in so many different directions and like literally goes on like take down different pathways, like with the young friend boy kind of leaving the cabin at one point and going off into the woods for a whole long sequence. I don't know what you thought of it, but it just like has so many ideas, and every sequence seems like it's trying something new.
Yeah, I really liked it, and I felt the same way, that it just also felt kind of so organic in how it's unpredictable. Like, it seems like you're going to be contained in these dinner sequences are going to be like the focus, and then it just keeps like overflowing or expanding outward somehow and then coming back. So you just really don't know what direction it's gonna go in. Even when like the impulses involved can be, you know, pretty familiar. Like, yeah, the kid is just like not handling his attraction very well. But that's not to say that the adults are handling what their tensions with any maturity either.
Right.
I don't know if I thought that somehow because they're Canadian that it wouldn't like it was they were going to work it out somehow. But you just don't really know where people's motives are going to take them or and how far. And they're totally stranded. One detail about where they are is that it's only accessible by like a little seaplane.
Oh, right.
So you just know they're stuck there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it starts with like a long, like Shining-esque opening, like following their car to the cabin, like with these overhead shots with this like droning score for like minutes on end. And it just like sets the mood like really perfectly. And I guess what's most impressive is it tries so many things and incorporates so many elements, but always maintains that tone without it like tipping over. Because there are sequences where there's literally like they break into song, but not in like a theatrical way. The one main one, I guess, involves them playing like a B-52 song, which references like a show that the screenwriter is now working on called Rock Lobster.
Right.
But but the guy puts it on like a turntable, the song, and then one person starts singing and dancing, and then like slowly everyone gets involved, and it just becomes this like really highly choreographed moment, which is, becomes like thrilling. And then it just stops and you're just into the next moment like nothing had happened. And there's multiple sequences like that, including one at the end where the sister character kind of starts singing to a song that's playing in the room. And it just becomes this like beautiful little moment that breaks the logic of like a normal narrative film, but is really like thrilling to watch.
Yeah. And that the latter one you mentioned is just an incredible like way out of that particular sequence that I think was able to sidestep a lot of fears I had about how things would resolve or not resolve.
Yeah.
In a really interesting way. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to like, I was talking to someone else who was like, I don't know if I could like believe that this would all happen in like a weekend or like to these people and then they would react this way. And I could see that. So it's sort of a movie that you have to like suspend some kind of disbelief in. But at the same time, it's like cinematically doing so many things that I was going with it. And every time it did something odd, it just made me more like happy with the idea or like the way it chose to move. And I guess I was sort of prepared for this because Lesage's last film, Genesis, which premiered in Locarno like 6 or 7 years ago, has a third act like narrative pivot, like unlike anything I've ever seen, I think, but definitely in like contemporary film. It just like takes the movie in a way total other direction and like pulls it off. And it just is like, I keep thinking about it even all these years later, like I haven't seen a movie like really try to or swing for something that big at like the last moment of a film or last act of a film. But this movie doesn't have like maybe one huge dramatic thing like that, but it has like a lot of little moments like that kind of like try something strange, try something different that a normal or more conventional filmmaker would I don't know, resolve in a different way.
No, that's true. I mean, I also thought that, I mean, I liked all the actors, I think really were good in kind of different ways too.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like the guy who's a screenwriter, I think he really taps into that guy's insecurities in a really good way. And then the director is kind of holds his cards close to his vest, and you kind of question his motives and exactly in what way he's sleazy.
Yeah, exactly, for sure. Though the screenwriter guy, the actor, I don't know who it is, but he's wonderful. He just plays like kind of a nerdy middle-aged guy who like is an alcoholic and yeah, definitely can't hold his like emotions or keep them to himself, and really flies off the handle here and there. But yeah, he's a great performance, and really it's quite funny, even though we're you know, seems like a very dramatic film, and it is at times, but it is very funny as well, and just has a ton of ideas, and you don't always get that at a festival. So anytime a movie's like really shooting for the moon, it excites me.
Yeah, no, I it's the same. I mean, also because in a way, bringing people together under the same roof for some like secrets will come out or who knows what or old tensions, you know, it just like blows past any worry about cliches there. So just like
Yeah,
so.
totally. And it stands apart from like, I mean, I don't watch everything obviously that comes out of Canada, but like it stands apart from like a lot of contemporary Canadian indie cinema, whether that's like Kaza Grodwanski, who had a film in Berlin, you know, from Toronto, or that those kind of people that are still making films in Toronto, and then or like Denis Côté, who's French Canadian as well, but like very different than any of those filmmakers' work. This is like operating in a much more like, in some ways, traditional narrative sense, in the way that it's telling dramatic, semi-humorous stories, but in another way, it's like more ambitious than those because it's like really bursting the form of a narrative in interesting ways.
Definitely. And I'm glad you mentioned the drone-like opening, because in a way that's like gets you on the wavelength that it's not going to be, you know, exactly what you expect. It kind of hypnotizes you to get into the state for the film.
Yeah, and one person actually pointed out that there's like a couple Bresson references in the film, and
Oh yeah.
he's not a filmmaker I would like compare this movie to, but in that opening sequence, I think there's a reference to Bresson with the hands in the opening car scene, and then at the end of the film, which won't give anything away, but there's a moment where like a character rolls into a lake, and it's like a direct reference to a Mouchette, I think, or one of those Bresson films from that era. So yeah, it's he has like good taste as well as good instincts.
Yeah. So that's Who by Fire. I guess in French it's like the fire, comme le feu.
Yeah, I don't know. I was before I picked up on the Leonard Cohen thing, I was like just thinking it was a not a mistranslation, but just like a poetic translation of the French title. But it works sort of, I guess, like thematically.
Yeah, I think so. It just it yeah, it kind of opens things up in a nice way. Well, speaking of another film that also I really didn't know where it was going to go, the Matias Pinheiro movie, Tu me abraças.
You burn me.
You Burn Me is the
Yeah.
is the translation. I guess some in the outlines it's almost like a lyrical romantic poem in film form or something like that.
No, it definitely is. Yeah. I mean, it's more or less an experimental film. Like, I would say definitely more than Pinheiro's other films, which are always doing something strange with form and adaptation and language. But this is like fully trying to, I think, take on the form of like a film poem. I guess, you know, if anyone knows Pinheiro's films, he has made a career out of adapting Shakespeare. So this is, I believe, his first film not based on a Shakespeare play. This is based on a chapter from a 1947 Cesare Pavese book, which I guess I have not read this, but it deals with the Greek poet Sappho and also the Greek goddess Rhitomartis. And it basically has them speaking about romance and love and failed love and death. But the way he adapts this is like not in a traditional way. Pinheiro incorporates like not only text from the actual chapter of the book, but also elements from the two female characters as well, the real woman's life, the poet, and then also the mythological character's life as well, and combines those with Pavese's own like tragic suicide. So all these elements are playing with the real elements, mythological elements, but it's also just telling the story or these stories through like film form, like actual excerpts from the text, like visual, like actual pages shown on screen, and then also voiceover and I don't know, just very repetitious imagery. And I don't know, to me, the thing I reached for, like the reference point I kept going back to was Strobe Houillier and the way they would adapt texts in these interesting ways. This movie is much more montage based than their films, but I got at something in that same kind of philosophical realm. So it's sort of a hard movie to access. Some of his films are like that for me, and this one might be even more so in some ways, but it's also like a really interesting like cinematic thought experiment about how to adapt a text. And it's really beautiful throughout. I think it's shot on film, and a couple of the actresses I think are his longtime collaborators, so they pop back up. But it's definitely not a traditional narrative film, and I can't really tell you what it is all getting at, but it's only about an hour long, but it's very hypnotizing and just beautiful to look at from moment to moment.
Yeah, it's weird because I was just thinking, Why did this film feel more like a short? And I guess part of it is that it is a little shorter than like a typical feature length, but I think it just in the in its formal experimentation, it feels that boldness, that freedom that you might associate more with like a, you know, some classic American avant-garde short, you know, like the use of montage and like iteration, like these kind of iterative editing where it's almost like a series of images might be like a refrain that you run through.
Repeats like dialogue, like different words are spoken over and over, including the title of the film is like written down in different languages and repeated. And there's a certain sequence at the beginning which repeats throughout the film, like it's like someone trying to get into a building and pushing like the buzzer, and then like a water in a faucet, and then there's like the shutter effect on the outside of like a building, like an architecture type shot that's used like as a trio or quartet of shots throughout the film that keeps returning to that. And so yeah, there's a strange rhythm to the film that you don't really know. It feels almost endless in some ways because it just doesn't have a normal structure. But at the same time, when it does end, it kind of has a beautiful little flourish, and it just kind of, I don't know, wraps up nicely. And I don't know, it's just a nice film. I don't know how to explain it.
I mean, even as it's dealing with sometimes kind of anguished feelings about either desire or, I mean, suicide and like, you know, that kind of, I don't know, recursion or something to kind of make sense just with the, I don't know, the intensity of those emotions. And I think there's also something about the poems of Sappho that it draws on a lot of it fragmentary, and just the feeling of lack or the there's something amazing that happens with those fragments. I think that they express so much and yet there's so much left behind.
Yeah, for sure. There's only one surviving, I think, like a whole work of theirs in existence, right? So the idea of adapting like a lot of fragmentary texts is like part of the idea behind the film, I think. Yeah, I don't know. It's one of the more interesting like attempts to like, I don't know, investigate the idea of adapting something, which is what his work has always dealt with. But this is like even more mysterious or cryptic in some ways. Like I was saying, it's hard to kind of wrap your head around, but it's never less than like fascinating.
And then the last thing is just, I think the title itself is an actual fragment from Sappho, which is amazing to think that that's what survived of the of whatever poem it was that one phrase. It's just it's kind of incredible.
Totally.
So Matias Pinheiro, that was in Encounters. Elsewhere is the Tsai Ming Liang movie, which was called Abiding Nowhere, which I think is also going to be showing at the Smithsonian Museum of Asian Art in like a week or so.
Oh, did not know that.
And yeah, that this is another in his Walker series, but I think the special aspect to this one is that it's shot in the environs of DC, in Washington, DC. So kind of new territory. So if you had to rank the Walker films, no.
I would say this is maybe not the top tier, but maybe just under that. I have not seen every Walker film. I think there's 10 of them now, 9 or 10. But this is the first one set in the US. And so seeing, if you know the idea behind the Walker films, is essentially Lee Kang-shang, who's, you know, Tsai's partner and longtime lead actor, dressed up like a monk and also walking like extremely slowly, like a meditative walk through public spaces. So he's barely moving and people are walking at normal speed around him, oftentimes ignoring him, sometimes looking and wondering what this strange person is doing. So it contains all these kind of strange visual elements, even though the camera's like not moving and Lee Kang-shang is barely moving at all. So the unique part of this film is that, yeah, it is set in Washington, D.C. So you can see Lee walking in front of the Washington Monument and the train station and in museums and things like that. So it also stars the co-star from Days, the guy that was introduced in Days, I guess, who's been now in he was also in the last Walker film, which is called Where, the one that was set at in Paris at the Pompidou. But that, I don't know, that film to me there was some sort of logic between the characters where they were meeting, they were in separate areas of Paris, and then but they were going to converge eventually at the Pompidou. Whereas this film, I'm not really sure what the relationship was between them. They don't ever connect, I don't believe. And it's just kind of them both doing their separate things. But yeah, I mean, these films are really, if you're on their wavelength, they're just like pure cinema. You sit there and just watch like these sometimes like incredible shots just unfold. And Tsai definitely uses the monuments and the architecture and the landscapes of Washington, D.C. in a very interesting way.
just so people are clear, like Li Kangxing is moving. He's taking step by step with an almost imperceptible rate of movement.
Yeah.
So it's the sort of thing like it's some like horror movie or something where you look away. It's like,
Yeah.
I mean, not literally, but just in the sense like, did that move? You know, did the statue move? He's like a moving statue. But I guess it's something that, I don't know, was inspired by the story of a 7th-century monk who walked from China to India, I suppose, at this pace or something like this pace.
Right.
Which is so interesting that because it kind of opens up like this contemplative space, just kind of bodily, like it kind of forces you to. I mean, as his films often do, and a lot of his feature films or dramatic features often involve people like walking some long distance from like across the screen or from like deep background to the foreground. Yeah, something about that progression or something he's really interested in slowing things down and.
Yeah, there was of a new element. I'm not sure. I haven't seen all the longer films, like I said, but I think this might have been the first one that there's music in. There's a couple moments, I think one at the beginning, one at the end, where there's like a swelling little motif, which I noticed at least, which normally the films are, it's just like the ambient noise of the surroundings. So yeah, that was maybe a new wrinkle. And then also there was one shot, I don't know if you remember it. Li Kangxing is like walking toward the camera, like directly, and it's like it frames his whole body, but you can see, which is the benefit of a theatrical viewing, I guess. You can see his feet like pointed, like a toes pointed toward the camera, and you can see when he's moving and getting closer to like the concrete, his like toes start to shake a little bit as they like he's anticipating getting to the ground, which you don't always get to see because normally he's framed kind of farther. So I was like, you finally get to see like the muscle control that you assume is obviously happening, but like you get to see his like feet like getting ready to touch the concrete, which I thought was interesting.
It's almost like a little trembling or something, which I mean, yeah, feels like a natural result of having to maintain. Like that. And I guess that's also maybe gestures a little just to how we've like over the years now we've seen him kind of his body undergo so much in size films, you know, the elements or like various strange pain treatments in like days. And here, yeah, and the Walker films. Yeah, it's intriguing. And then yeah, you mentioned the other character that they don't cross paths with in this and he I guess is Thai, I want to say he's Thai. Is that right?
Yeah, I think
Thai.
so.
He's like doing his own thing, which is a lot of, I mean, prominently like preparing noodles. So it's kind of interesting seeing that kind of very domestic, mundane activity next to this other activity, which I guess is sort of mundane because it's walking, but is also on some other like spiritual or ritual plane. So I kind of like that put together. I have to hope or assume that that'll come to projections or something like that. That would be nice.
Not all of them travel. I mean, there's a, like I said, there's been a lot of them now. People don't even realize. Most of them are shorter. This is a feature, and so was Where, and there's a couple others that are in the hour range, but there's some of them that are more like 30 minutes or 40 minutes. But yeah, the features, at least the last two have been quite nice. So hopefully they travel.
So that's Abiding Nowhere. That can bring us to another film, I guess, by an auteur with a very distinctive style, or although not a feature film. Kiyoshi Kurosawa was, I guess, a late addition to the festival. I don't know if that was just the timing of the announcement, but I think there were all the announcements about the different lineups. And then closer to the festival, there was just like a separate one for this film, and I think one or two other films, or maybe more. It's called Chime.
Well, it's a 45-minute movie by Kiyoshi Kurosawa. I guess the story follows, I guess he's a culinary school teacher, middle-aged guy, as he's teaching his class, and it opens on this classroom setting in a kitchen where one of his students starts to act a little strange and reveals that he hears a chiming sound in his head. And then also something to the effect of like his brain has been replaced by like a contraption or a machine of some sort. So he reveals this odd thing and that he's hearing like this noise in his head. But the teacher doesn't ignore it, but he just like they continue on with the day. And then like the next day or soon after that, they're back in the classroom and like a female student starts acting strange. And hers thing deals with like her being like weirded out by like a piece of chicken, not a piece of chicken, but like a whole chicken. And yeah, it's a very strange setup to a movie, but basically these two younger characters like reveal this strange like things that's possessing them or like some odd like affliction, and slowly, it seems that something similar starts to kind of take over the teacher's day-to-day life. He lives at home with his wife and his son. And yeah, he starts acting weird slowly. I didn't get entirely like what the relationship was between the two kids' like problems and then what eventually like takes over him, which he becomes more I don't know, violent, let's say. And so it becomes kind of a domestic thriller, I guess I could say, without giving too much away. But it's very like a super slow burn, even though it's only 45 minutes. It's very like hypnotic, and there's not a ton of dialogue, and it's all very cryptic, cryptically told. But I mean, Kurosawa is like a master of space and atmosphere, and it works on that level like extremely well. And it's pretty unsettling, even though I wasn't quite sure, like I said, exactly what it was getting at all the time.
Yeah, well, that makes me feel a little better. I was sure I had like missed something, but maybe I didn't.
No, I don't think so. Well, I don't know. Maybe I missed something too. But it's yeah, more for me, more like a work of atmosphere and the soundscape and the blocking and the just the way he frames this these kind of like macabre moments, which come more toward the end. It's very tense and unique.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned like the blocking things, because one thing I really noticed, I mean, this was paired with another film, I guess from the same production company, I think is the connection. And I'm not gonna like put down that film, but just having them side by side, it just made one like intensely aware of like Kurosawa's depth of staging he does, and just how rich his imagery could be, even when it's in like, yeah, it's like in a test kitchen, or like outside a doorbell or something like that,
Yeah, I was done a disservice a little bit by that film too. I think at least for I went to the public screening, which showed the other film first and then the Kurosawa
Oh,
film, so
weird.
that could put me into like a stupor before that.
So yeah, Chime screening first, I guess, ended up being a good thing in the press screening. I didn't realize that's what happened in the public screening. It was interesting to see that. I don't know if that mid-length is just something tiding him over between features or what's coming up next for him.
Yeah, I mean, I know he has two features on the way. Presumably, both will premiere this year, including a French language one, which he's done before, but this one will, I guess, probably be in Cannes, just considering it's French. But yeah, he has two more features on the way.
Well, that's something to look forward to. So that brings us, I think, to Direct Action, which is a film that won the Encounters section, so doubly a reason to talk about it. But I think we'd probably be talking about it anyway because it's co-directed by Ben Russell, and I'm blanking already. He co-directed with his producer, right, or something, or.
Guillaume Caillou, who is he's produced some of Ben's films in the past, so they're I guess no strangers to working together, but this is a film they decided to co-direct because well, it deals with the Zone to Defend eco-activist collection, which is a large and controversial group in France, and Guillaume is French and had some connections with the group, so was able to help them kind of gain access and comfortability with the people who make up this collective, which is like 150 strong group that kind of lives autonomously and actually literally they set up an autonomous zone through multiple years in the 2010s and ultimately shut down a airport construction project that was going to take over a large portion of like the French countryside, which they now occupy. So yeah, they've had real world results as a result of their work. But this film is not like a typical look at an organization or a collective or a movement even. It's sort of an obliquely framed portrait of how these people live and the labor they partake in when they're not involved in direct action, so to speak. It builds eventually to a demonstration and action in the French countryside, but for most of like the 3 hours and 36 minutes, it is basically shots of the day-to-day activities of these people, which entails just cooking or farming. There's a sequence, a quite humorous sequence of people playing chess. So yeah, it's told in static shots of these activities, and there's 41 shots in total, so these are quite lengthy, like about 8 to 10 minutes, I think, in each case. And it just slowly kind of opens up from these activities to what becomes in the second half of the film. Details are revealed that they're planning to confront or try to shut down a reservoir project that the government is mounting. So they finally get some details where there's some speaking and they talk a little bit about what they have planned. And then it eventually moves into actual footage of them organizing and going out on these tractors. So they enlist a lot of the local farmers who are also opposed to this project. These sequences are also filmed in like static shots of them approaching this reservoir and the cops kind of coming at them in, you know, riot gear and shooting tear gas bombs at them as they stage this protest. So it turns into like a literal like war type scene with smoke and violence and things like this. But it's all captured in this like one or two shots that kind of end this film in this very like dramatic and kind of a catastrophic way. But for the most part, it's a very quiet, contemplative film that just like draws you into like the activities of the group working on the land, building and living in this autonomous region of France, which has become, I guess, it's a very hot button issue in France. But yeah, the way it's portrayed here is not very contentious. I mean, them and their lives are very quotidian and somewhat quaint, and yeah, doing everything to like live off the land. And so it turns into a powerful film, but it's very much in like the Ben Russell style of like, I don't know, aestheticizing or making something quite beautiful out of the natural world. And, you know, obviously shot on film too. So yeah, it looks amazing. And yeah, I won the Encounters Prize, which I think is a deserved winner. It certainly feels the biggest and most like substantial film of Encounters probably.
I mean, that's all intriguing to me. Because I haven't seen this one, but it only makes me want to see it all the more. But just this idea of showing them, not structuring it so that it's basically about their confrontation, you know, initially, or about how they're like causing a rupture in things. Initially, it's starting out with them in their context.
Yeah, you would never know that what their ultimate goals are in life. It's not presented with any context, really. It does open with a small scene of like, I don't know if it's Ben and Guillaume or a few people like looking at footage of past Zad kind of confrontations with the police. So you've got to get a hint that there's something violent in the material, but then it just switches to like the actual, this region, which is very peaceful looking and beautiful. So yeah, but without that, there's really no indication that where it's going to go. So it's sort of a very obliquely told film, but yeah, if you stick with it, it eventually reveals the information you need to kind of glean what's happening. And then at the end, you kind of get a scene where they more openly discuss like the politics behind the group and what they're standing for, which in a normal film, you'd get that earlier. And right. So it's structured in a very interesting way, which is provocative and like challenging in its own way, but it's an impressive film for sure. And, you know, Ben comes back with like a real significant film every few years. Like this is probably the best one since Good Luck, which was his film about a mining community, which premiered in Locarno like 6 or 7 years ago.
What do you make of the title?
The title is, come to find out, and it was what I kind of presumed, is like a comment on direct cinema. I mean, it obviously means direct action in the sense that the community is taking direct action, but
right.
But it has like a double meaning where it's sort of commenting on direct cinema and like maybe the limitations of what certain forms of nonfiction cinema could be, or the limitations of what a portrait type film could be. You know, direct cinema has a unique aesthetic where it seems very like a fly on the wall, but and it can be very kinetic.
Right.
But whereas this film's very stately and calm for most of it. And by the time you do get to the direct action, it's like, you know, 3 hours into the movie. So yeah, it's sort of, I think, supposed to comment on like ideas related to direct cinema, nonfiction.
Yeah.
Storytelling.
No, I mean, I like that because why couldn't direct cinema be more durational? You know, if it's sometimes the fly just sits on the wall. So I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's direct action. And I think we can probably end it there just in terms of like going deep on films. But I do want to just mention a couple other documentaries that were also kind of prominent, but also maybe not discussed as much because they seemed in different ways possibly familiar. One is the Nicolas Philibert movie at Averroes and Rosa Parks. This is, I guess, the second part of what's going to be a trilogy, the first part being On the Adamant, which won the Golden Bear last year. On the Adamant is this kind of workshop, cultural space, decompression zone for psychiatric patients. This film is set in a psychiatric ward. So it's really sit downs with patients, most of all, and you know, also a little about the doctors. So sometimes it can be sort of harrowing. Sometimes it's just really unnervingly like candid, just in the way sometimes people can talk. And also there's like a couple of like really entertaining patients. There's one patient who I think is sort of in there as maybe sort of like a mirror to like the typical, I don't know, or a possible typical like bourgeois moviegoer, this kind of manic character. And then, yeah, there's definitely unhappy stories for sure. But I thought it was pretty strong. And then Favoriten from Ruth Beckermann, who won a prize, I think last year, for Butzenbacher. Favoriten is set in a primary school in Austria, and it's basically, the big thing is that it follows these students, these same students with a teacher over a few years, starting with the second grade. So it's just about as sweet as you might expect in that regard, but also, you know, goes through the challenges of conflict resolution is really big in the classroom. So is learning your, you know, times tables and whatever. I liked it. You know, might bring to mind Mr. Bachman and his class, which was a 3-hour opus about a teacher in Germany. It's in some ways similar, but kind of made him out to be more of this like character, this figure. Whereas here, I don't know, it somehow got into the like, since it wasn't like foregrounding, that the person whose name is Ilke Idiskut, you get really into the hard work minute to minute of like conflict resolution, teaching, managing feelings, and just kind of helping people come to be the people that they are going to be.
Right. I enjoyed the film as well. I guess going in, I thought I was going to have like maybe some issues overcoming one, having to come after Mr. Bachman and his class, but also there was a film by Eric Baudelaire that I like called Un Film Dramatique as well, which follows a French school. So yeah, but they're all kind of made in the same way. But this film, I think, has a emotional dimension to it. I think as a result of the kids being with this teacher for so many years and then leaving, eventually the film kind of climaxes with them having to part ways, which I found quite moving. But yeah, it's a very, very nice film, but also has a subtle or implicit political dimension with the makeup of the students, which are mostly all, they're not Austrian. So that opens up, you know, a whole other dimension to the film as well, which ultimately makes it maybe has some more heft than might initially come off. But I really enjoyed the film, and it was cool to see the teacher was in person at the festival. So that was kind of cool to see. I don't know if the kids came, but she was there and got to present the film, I guess, with Ruth Beckermann, which is, very nice.
No, that's great. You're just really impressed. I mean, you know, I don't know, as I usually am by teachers.
Yeah.
And yeah, the students, they come, their families come from, you know, Syria, Turkey, Albania, I think Bulgaria was also in there. Yeah, just watching everyone navigate. I guess a lot of kind of gender dynamic issues tend to come up as well. And it's also, I think, broaches some religious subjects.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, because they go to, is it a Catholic church at some point?
Yeah.
Yeah, not everyone obviously has the same backgrounds. And so, yeah, there is an interesting kind of dynamic there as well.
Well, I mean, it's this great kind of moment of they go to the Catholic church and the priest asks, you know, wait a second, is anyone Catholic? And no one, none of the kids are Catholic.
Yeah.
And I just love it because it's this total like decentering moment for that guy and for like, you know, tradition there. Because like, for all the kids, they're like, who is that guy on the cross? Like, basically, you know, it's like,
yeah.
So yeah, that's Favoriten. And yeah, plenty else that could be mentioned. I'll just quick other word for Intercepted, mostly as a movie, a documentary that I'm still kind of chewing over. I don't know, did you catch that one?
I did not, no. Tell me about it.
Well, I mean, that's just the one where the audio of the film is taken from intercepted phone conversations only, I guess, from Russian soldiers from Ukraine, you know, where they are on the front lines back home. So sounds like mostly to their mothers.
Yeah.
Sometimes it sounded like could be to their partners and other, I mean, occasionally to like a male relative, but actually mostly to female relatives, which is kind of interesting. The visuals are of sites in Ukraine, not with Russian soldiers, but just devastated buildings or landscapes, or just like little, almost like vignettes, like looking at this giant hole that has been made in a street after a bomb has just dropped and everyone's just kind of figuring out what to do about it. Or like, I don't know, just friendly gatherings. So just the counterpoint between these things, or sometimes just people sitting in like their blown out, you know, living room, effectively in shock or something. And meanwhile, you're hearing these conversations. And I mean, the conversations are, it's rough, like, because for this reason, because pretty much everything you would fear that they have done, they talk about having done.
Yeah.
So that means like shooting mothers of children in front of their children. Hmm. That includes rounding up people to go to the forest to shoot them down. That includes eating a dog because they were sick of their rations. Hmm. That includes any number of these things. That includes just like sounding like kind of psychotic and bloodthirsty.
Yeah.
There's no comfort necessarily from the people back home. A lot of times they're just like spouting all the kind of pro-Russian propaganda and every, you know, Ukraine deserves everything and all this. A small, small minority of the conversations are where usually one side, I think a couple of cases both, are just like, I can't believe this. I can't believe what you're having to do. This is all like scam. You know, this is all bullshit. This is terrible. Yeah. You know, I can't even talk anymore. But actually, mostly it's not. So not an easy movie to, I was going to say watch, but not an easy movie to listen to.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear that there's something to discover, because I was thinking how this year, at least for me, I was aware of or know of most of the filmmakers that I was watching, which is always good because you come in with some kind of background with them or whatever. I think Republic was maybe the only like out of the blue film that I even watched, well, or just one or two. So yeah, in that sense, I think this festival, this year's edition at least, has like a deeper, potentially deeper selection of films than maybe we anticipate, because compared to last year, which I think a lot of people were saying last year was maybe better than this year, which I don't actually agree with, but I think last year had maybe a couple marquee titles like A Fire, Christian Petzold film, or Music by Anna Chanelak, which maybe stood out above the fray, which there might not be those this year as much, but I think there's many more good films, especially in other sections. Like, you know, we're talking about films and not only Encounters, but like Berlin on a Special, and in that generation with Who by Fire. So I think it's a deep year. And in that sense, I think like a good way or cool way to go out for this team.
No, I agree. I think that's a really good way of putting it. The Human Hibernation was also just kind of, you know, it could have been that or another movie. It happened to be that. So I was happy to see that one too. But yeah, we can wrap it up there on a strong selection. And yeah, thanks again.
Yeah, no problem.
I'll see you at the next one.
Yeah, see you soon.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.